So a man enters a monastery. How do you know? And each person can say two words every 7 years. He's very faithful in practice, commits himself to the community there. His time comes before the elders. He sits with them and he says, "Room cold." He returns, spends another 7 years in prayer and contemplation and study. Sits with the elders again, says, "Food bad." Returns, more prayer, more contemplation, more study. 21 years. Comes back before the elders, says, "Goodbye." The elders turn to him and say, "That's good. All you've done is complain from the moment you got here." And typically in our community, the rabbi doesn't speak at Bethel on Kol Nidre. I'm grateful to our president, Rachel Galanter, and I'm grateful to you for giving me much more than two words every 7 years and for listening to a second reflection tonight. I wanted to talk tonight because what I want to discuss is important. It's deserving of reflection on Kol Nidre when as close to our whole community as possible is gathered together. I want to talk about marriage. This is the talit that was Jennifer and my chuppah. I wanted to wear it for tonight. Marriage in the Jewish tradition has a few different names, but the most common is kiddushin, from the root kadosh, commonly translated as holy or set aside for an elevated purpose. Kiddushin is the act of two people setting themselves aside from the rest of the world for each other for an elevated purpose. You might think that that elevated purpose is just having children, but it's not. According to the Talmud, couples who are too old to procreate are not prohibited from being married. Rashi's grandson, Rabbeinu Tam, permits relations with a barren woman for the purposes of physical and emotional pleasure. And Abu Draham, the 14th century commentator of Jewish liturgy, states that the reason no blessing for children is recited at a Jewish wedding is that couples incapable of bearing children merit the full seven blessings of the Jewish wedding ceremony. The sacred purpose of Jewish marriage, then, is not merely the biological imperative to procreate, but also includes the emotional intimacy and growth that occur when one human being commits one's life to the well-being of another human being. The Bible, especially the first few chapters of Genesis, is full of what scholars call etiologies, a fancy word for stories that tell you about origins, about where things come from. For the Torah, the etiology of marriage is the verse that is on your cards tonight. I hope you have them. If not, you can get one when you go out. The verse is Lo Tov, Heyot Adam Levado, it is not good for a person to be alone. God creates Adam, the first person, not a man and not a woman, according to rabbinic tradition, a person, and says it is not Tov for a human being to be alone. A human being should exist in relationship. And so God begins by creating a partner for Adam, Eve. Too many people read that word tov as a moral word, as if the Torah is saying that a person who is alone is doing somehow something that is not good, that is wrong. How many times have I sat with people in my office or in the lobby who have looked at me and told me that as single people, in the Jewish community, they feel less than. That the goal of organized Jewish life seems to have for single people to marry them off. And that until they are married off, they are somehow some sort of flaw that is waiting to be fixed. That is not what the word tov means in this context. God creates light, and it was tov. God puts the waters in one place and the land in another and saw that it was tov. God creates. And when God creates, God decrees these things to be good because they are whole, because they are complete. When God says it is not tov for a person to be alone, the Torah is saying that a fundamental part of being a human being is having a connection to other people. As the biblical scholar Nahum Sarna writes in the Jewish Publication Society commentary on the Torah, the idea here is that man is recognized to be a social being. Celibacy is undesirable. Put another way, a whole individual is an oxymoron. The Jewish model for piety is not a hermit, not a mystic on a mountaintop, or even a very pious, unmarried, single person. We are whole. We are tov when we are in relationships with an other or with others. We find this wholeness through friendship, through community, through family, through what happens here at Bethel in our communal life. One of the deepest realizations of this wholeness, of how we grow our soul into a fuller human being, is found through the intimacy of romantic love and commitment to nurturing another soul. That is the beginning of marriage. God tries to make Adam an ezer kenegdo, a helper, challenger, by pairing Adam with one of the animals, but it doesn't work. So God forms a second human being who Adam declares is bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, and then the Torah declares, therefore a man leaves his mother and father and clings to his wife. This is where marriage comes from, traditional heterosexual marriage. In rabbinic terms, there is erasha, an initial premise, that it is not good for human beings to be alone, and a seifa, an end conclusion. A man marries a woman, and for thousands of years, heterosexual marriage was the one seifa, the one end conclusion to the resha, that it is not tov for a human being to be alone. For centuries, our tradition cultivated a belief that there is one person out there, our beshert, waiting for us. However romantic such a notion might be, our too rigid notions around marriage have a darker side. A few years ago, I wrote a bulletin article against the idea of beshert. For some, a rabbi speaking out against beshert was like being against Shabbat or keeping kosher. But I really mean it. I do not believe in beshert. I looked it up. One definition read, a person's soulmate considered a predestined ideal, considered as predestined or ideal. Who could be against that? And don't get me wrong, to believe the heavens conspired to bring two people together is a romantic notion, but too often believing in beshert isn't romantic. It's painful. First, if you believe a person has one soulmate, what do you say to a widow? That your life is over because your one beshert is gone? To believe in one's beshert risks trapping a widow into years of loneliness rather than opening up possibilities of new companionship and unforeseen but beautiful future. To a single person who wants to be married, Bashert says that they must somehow be undeserving of God's love, that God was either too busy to find them a soulmate, or that their loneliness is the result of some secret sin. And to people who are struggling with their marriage or have gotten divorced, does Bashert mean that their marriage up until that point was just somehow against God's plan? That the children who were born from their marriage, that the life that they built together, that the love that they felt under the chuppah, that all of it was somehow some sort of misreading of God's plans for their lives? As if the pain of divorce wasn't enough, Bashert compounds that pain by robbing a couple of their past, even as they struggle to move forward into an unknown future. And what about someone in an abusive marriage? God forbid. Does Bashert mean somehow that the person should stay? Because once you get married, the person who you are married to constitutes some sort of eternally predestined ideal? My friend and colleague, Rabbi Perry Netta, wrote a book called Divorce is a Mitzvah, a provocative title, if there ever was one. His point is that while divorce is tragic, the fact that the Torah itself prescribes a method for divorce, look at Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 1, means that divorce can sometimes be a holy path that one must follow. But his point is larger than just divorce. Unlike the notion of Bashert, Jewish life offers many possible paths to companionship, not one. Some are ones we hope for, others are a path we never would have chosen, but in which we can continue to find love and renewal. The Torah's path is not locked into finding holy companionship with one and only one person. So says Jeremiah, Chastei Hashem ki lo tamu ki lo chalu rachamav. Adonai's loving kindnesses never cease. God's compassions are never exhausted. They are new every morning. How great is your faithfulness, O God. Which brings me to the heart of what I want to discuss with you tonight, the question of Jewish, gay, and lesbian marriage. Many of you were here, some of you were not, when I interviewed to be the rabbi of Bethel 4.5 years ago. I was asked then by the teens and others about Judaism and homosexuality, about whether I would officiate at a gay marriage. There are ways that I wish I had answered that question differently. I gave technical answers that don't reflect the compassion and love I feel, and I apologize to the people who were hurt by my answers, and I ask your forgiveness tonight. I now know that all of the candidates, of all of them, I was the only one who did not say unequivocally that I would perform a gay marriage. Why would I not make that promise? What I said then, and what I still believe today, is something that I spoke about a few weeks ago on Shabbat, that the Torah does not exist just in an ark or in the black and white pages of ancient books, but rather that the fullest and most authentic expression of Torah exists in relationship between two human faces. I want you to look up there. You can't see it so well tonight, but the third stained glass window in. You'll come back, you'll see it tomorrow morning. It is a representation of the holy ark. And in that representation, based upon the Jewish tradition, we learn that God's voice emanated from between two cherubim, two kruvim, who looked at each other face to face. That's where God's voice comes from. A rabbi of a community is called a mara d'atra, an expression that literally means in Aramaic a master of the place. And it means that a rabbi's authority, his or her ability to engage in a conversation about the meaning of the Jewish tradition, is tied to a particular place, a particular community, to the faces and the souls of real people before whom the rabbi is accountable and from whom he or she cannot hide. We hear God's voice emanate from between two faces because the Torah is not cold and technical. It is not a theoretical question. And the words of Torah don't exist in a vacuum. God's loving presence emerges in the context of real people and real life, asking and answering holy questions. 4.5 years ago, I refused to say unequivocally, yes, I will perform a gay marriage ceremony, because I wasn't here. Some people in the community were left to wonder what my unwillingness to answer meant. But the community trusted in me, and I'm grateful for your trust. I didn't know you, and you didn't know me, and I'm grateful that we know each other better now. And the time has come to answer, and my answer is yes. Why is it yes? One important reason is bound up with my ordination as a conservative rabbi. My membership in the Rabbinical Assembly, the Organization of Conservative Rabbis, and my reliance upon the authority of the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards, a committee that sets halachic or Jewish legal policy for Rabbinical Assembly rabbis, and for the conservative movement as a whole. The question of gay marriage and the ordination of gays as rabbis was first asked of the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards, the CJLS, in 1990. And while the movement, myself of course included, has always supported the full civil equality for the GLBT community, the answer in 1992 was no. Rabbi Joel Roth, a creative jurist who years before was seen as liberal when he authored a teshuvah, a response that ultimately permitted the admission of women into rabbinical school, could find no way in his tshuva, even though he wanted to override what he understood to be an explicit Torah prohibition against homosexual relationships. Years passed. Conversations continued until in 2006. The Committee on Jewish Law and Standards passed two conflicting tshuvot. One was by Rabbi Roth, that ultimately reiterated the continued impermissibility of homosexual relationships as an authentic interpretation of Jewish to be sanctioned by Jewish tradition, and a second one by Rabbis Elliot Dorf, Danny Nevins, and Avram Reisner that opened the door to admitting GLBT students to rabbinical schools and permitting RA rabbis to perform marriages for Jewish gays and lesbians. How can two opposing positions be simultaneously true? The committee's action is based upon the Talmud. Thousands of years before, when a voice from God declares in Masechet Eruvin about the opposing arguments of Hillel and Shammai, Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim, these and these are the words of the living God. It is based on the idea that the Torah has, that there are 70 panim la Torah, 70 faces of the Torah. That God's greatness comes from the ability to speak, as the Midrash says, to each person in the voice of our mother and our father in just the way that we need for God to hear us. Both responsa approved by the committee are a true and authentic interpretation of the Jewish tradition, and the committee permits each congregational rabbi and rabbinical school to decide which responsum to adopt and hence set its own policy on the subject. Some rabbis moved forward in performing marriages for Jewish gays and lesbians in 2006 through ceremonies that they created. It was not until 2 years ago, in 2012, that the committee also adopted and approved ceremonies for these weddings. The tshuvot, all of them available on the internet for those who are interested, are serious and complex analyses of Jewish legal sources spanning 2,000 years of Jewish tradition. Rosh Tshuva from 1992 is 68 pages of small writing, single-spaced. His 2006 revisiting of the topic numbers another 34 pages. The Tshuva by Rabbis Dorf, Nevins, and Reisner numbers 36 pages and includes citations and analysis from scientific as well as Talmudic sources. I cannot relate all of the arguments tonight, but the crux of the argument can be summed up as follows. Rabbis Dorf, Nevins, and Reisner demonstrated how the Jewish legal concept of kavod habriot, the honor due to all human beings, has in the past overridden rabbinic and even Torah prohibitions. And they argued that it should do so in this case as well. Put another way, basic considerations of human dignity mandate that the Torah must provide a path to sanctify the love of gay and lesbian Jews. Rabbi Steve Greenberg is a gay Orthodox rabbi. Before he came out of the closet, he wrote under a pseudonym, Yaakov Levado, meaning Jacob is alone. A quotation from when Jacob wrestles with the angel alone at night. What is the effect of continuing to uphold the Jewish tradition's long-standing rejection of homosexual behavior? Rabbi Greenberg writes as follows. He says, the standard Orthodox position is to require celibacy. The homosexual is asked to live a loveless life. I have lived, writes Rabbi Greenberg, portions of my adult life as a celibate clergyman. While it can have spiritual potency for a Moses or a Ben Azai who abandoned sexual life for God or Torah, it is not a Jewish way to live, he writes. Always sleeping alone, in a cold bed, without touch, without the daily physical interplay of lives morning and night, this celibate scenario is a life-denying and, for me, he writes, has always led to a shrinking of spirit. What sort of Torah, what voice of God would demand celibacy from all gay people? Such a reading of divine intent is nothing short of cruel. Last fall, I met with two men in our community, one of whom is Jewish, the other of whom, his fiancée, is not, but who is interested in studying with me to convert. When he completes his conversion, they said to me, "We'd like you to marry us." There it was. The question had been asked, not in theory, not as an issue, not in cold technical language, but by two people sitting before me who are committed to the Jewish tradition. One who wants to convert, another who is a committed and knowledgeable member of our community. They looked into my eyes. They wanted to know, what does the Torah say to our love? They wanted to know, do you believe and practice a Torah of cruelty? Or is a Torah of cruelty an oxymoron? Must we choose, they were asking, between, on the one hand, our love for the Torah and the Jewish people, and on the other hand, our love for one another? No, you don't need to choose. You can love Torah and you can love one another. When the time comes, I will perform their marriage and marriages of other gay and lesbian Jews who want to stand under the chuppah with me. The chuppah, the wedding canopy, is open on all sides, not only because it teaches us about the importance in the Jewish community of having an open home, but because marriage is something that should be open to every human being, because lo tov heyot adam levado, it is not good for a human being to be alone. A single person need not get married to find completeness. Marriage remains open, but in its absence, our community must be a place in which each person can give and receive love, care, and connection. When a Jew and a non-Jew fall in love, Jewish marriage is never closed. Conversion is always available to the non-Jewish partner. I am grateful for the respect that the non-Jewish partner demonstrates for the Jewish tradition by choosing not to just convert. Sure, it would be easier. It would be more convenient. But the person who is not Jewish, who marries someone Jewish, respects their own traditions, respects him or herself, and respects the Jewish tradition I know and love too much to do something so important with anything but the utmost authenticity and integrity. The doorway to the Jewish people and to a Jewish marriage remains open, always available and welcoming for the moment when it is right, not for me, not for Jewish demographics, not for their partner, but for him or her and God to walk through that door. Until that time, I want you to know that I am grateful for your presence in our community, for so many of you who trust in our tradition and choose to help raise Jewish children, and for so many of you who find wisdom in Jewish traditions and Jewish texts. You are welcome here as fellow travelers today and always.
but someone who is gay or lesbian cannot choose heterosexual love. In 1999, a collection of letters to and from the Orthodox Israeli philosopher Yeshayahu Leibovitz was published. One of them was from a man from a Hasidic family who were survivors of the Shoah. He writes as follows, quote, "From my earliest sentient days, and even before I could define it for myself, I have been attracted to men, a fact that has caused me much physical and spiritual agony throughout my studies at yeshiva and my residence in its dormitory. My dilemma is, how can the Jewish faith be reconciled with homosexuality? From what I know of your approach," this man writes to Leibovitz, "I expect that you will tell me the homosexual urge must be trumped by the overriding value of the service of God. There's the rub," he writes. "For me, this is an essential imprint on my life in general and on my family life and its associated obligations in particular. In my humble opinion, we have not yet understood the essence of this problem, and that is due to the fear that dealing with the issue inspires and because of the ignorance that necessarily affects those who have not yet experienced this." Leibovitz's response was, in my opinion, cruel, nearly obscene, in fact. He writes to the man as follows, "If you are concerned about Judaism," he writes, "and ask about how it can be reconciled with homosexuality, the answer is clear, unambiguous, and unequivocal. The reconciliation is impossible." In a PS to his response, Leibovitz even counsels the man of a terrible suggestion of the sages from the Babylonian Talmud. Quote, "Should a man feel that his urges are irresistible, let him go to a place where he is not recognized. Let him go incognito by wearing black clothes and by wrapping him in a black shawl and do what he feels he needs to do, and so not profane the name of God publicly." Unquote. To me, it is Leibovitz's suggestion that profanes God's name. Rabbis Dorf, Nevins, and Reisner find precedent in the Jewish tradition to set aside even a Torah law. By opening the door to Jewish marriage, they preserve the honor and dignity due to each human being, rather than exiling religiously observant gay Jews either to live in divinely mandated celibacy or to flout the Torah they so cherish. Let me share with you another text that was shared with me in this context by a friend and colleague, Rabbi Adam Kligfeld of Temple Beth Am in Los Angeles. We all know the story of the golden calf. Moses sees the people committing idolatry, he gets angry, he breaks the tablets. That's the story that is in the Torah. But in Avot Rebbe Natan, the rabbis tell a different story. They say Moses is coming down the mountain. He sees the people committing idolatry and he looks at the tablets. He specifically looks at commandment number 2, thou shalt not commit adultery. And at that moment, Moses says the following to himself. He says, if I give them these tablets, which technically I haven't yet done, and therefore they are not yet obligated to, then God will have to break them. God will have to break the people. Moses says to himself, according to this midrash, I'd rather break the tablets instead. And later the midrash says that Moses only broke the tablets because he was told to by God, as it is written, quote, mouth to mouth I speak with Moses, mouth to mouth I said to Moses, break the tablets. Moses is told by God himself to break the tablets and save the people. Breaking the law can save the law. Legal theorists know this as a judge who writes a new opinion becomes what Robert Cover called, quote, part of the bridge that links the official vision of the Constitution with the reality of people in jail. But this is not just about saving the law. God, says this midrash, told Moshe, break the law. Don't break people. Torah should not break people. We know Yom Kippur is a rehearsal of our deaths. We put on a kittel, a burial shroud. We don't eat, We don't drink. We don't shower. We let our bodies decay. But in the Hasidic tradition, Yom Kippur is not primarily a rehearsal of death. It is actually a marriage. Yes, today we confess our sins, but the story of Yom Kippur, the essence of Yom Kippur, is that today we are forgiven. Today, 10 days after Rosh Hashanah, 10 days and 7 weeks after Tisha B'Av, when God and the Jewish people felt so far away from one another, today is the day when the distance from God finally closes. It is a day of intimacy, a day of love, a wedding day. It is not tov for a person to be alone. Today is a Yom Tov, a good day. Today we come together. We set ourselves apart for an elevated, for a sanctified purpose, to be a community, a good, a whole community in which no one is broken, because in our brokenness and our love, we find wholeness and peace. L'shana Tova.